I just spent like the next 5 years essentially pulling back and just reading and thinking about, okay, what do I actually want to build? Like, forget all the startup advice. How do you actually build meaningful things? What's valuable in the world? What are important things happening right now? And then how can you leverage those trends to build something important?
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue and excuse for me to explore my curiosity through Combo's leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Alpha Berry. Alpha is the founder of Temple, which builds cities to make the world more prosperous and beautiful, as well as Monolith, which founds and funds companies building Africa's industrial economy. We talk about his vision for Temple and Monolith, why we need new cities and the opportunities and challenges of building them, and why Africa is the right place for these ventures. Please enjoy.
I'm Alpha, founder of Temple Cities. I was born in Ivory Coast, West Africa, and we lived there for about 8 years until civil war erupted in 2002, which forced us to flee the country. Spent about 5 years living in Senegal as a refugee, and then moved to the U.S. at 13. Now, I always start with that part of the story because that journey really colors everything I'm doing next. I always like to say that it is, if we're being dramatic, my origin story, because it was witnessing like a real coup d'etat that really sort of like taught me that most things are pretty fragile, actually. And you don't know how fragile they are until you're just caught in the eye of the storm. And so, you know, went to the U.S., went to the College of Women Mary, studied philosophy. The idea was to get into law initially, actually. It wasn't to be a philosopher. It wasn't so high-minded. But that was around like 2013. Around that time, I saw The Social Network. And it just became apparent that there were just other things that you could do in the world. There were just other avenues to be ambitious as opposed to just being a banker or a lawyer or a doctor, which is when you're an immigrant, it seems like these are the only things you can do. You know, just get a good, high-paying, six-figure job and then just give some money back to the family back on the continent. And I just wanted to break that mold. It just seemed like there were more interesting things to do. And so my senior year, a friend and I, we just started this P2P marketplace project. Didn't really go very far. It was a first failure. But the experience of building that, we just felt like we were, there was a bit of a LARP going because of course it was just right after seeing The Social Network, but it felt like we were actually learning how to do interesting things and novel things in the world. And that was an exciting journey. And that gave me the bug to eventually want to start something more ambitious over time. So after graduation, I tried launching another startup called Listener. It was a podcast aggregator startup right before podcasts like had this whole boom thing. But it, you know, we had some users, but it became clear initially that, you know, a giant company like Apple or like a better, more experienced software company like Spotify would own the space. And it just didn't feel like you could really make money on the aggregator side in podcasts. I think it's a creator focused industry, and I think it's actually better that way. You don't really want to repeat the old parasitic business models from like the Web 2 era in the space. And so we shut that down. And after that period, I just spent like the next 5 years essentially kind of like pulling back and just reading and thinking about, okay, what do I actually want to build? Like, forget all the startup advice you're reading, all the social network residue I gained from that period. How do you actually build meaningful things? What's valuable in the world? What are important things happening right now? And then how can you leverage those trends to build something important? So that whole journey, you know, led me to eventually what I'm doing now, Temple, which was founded in 2022. And yeah, I'll stop there. That was a bit long-winded, but you know, that's the journey.
No, I love it. There's this interesting progression in your journey where you came over with kind of this immigrant mindset of, I'm going to get a high-paying, stable job, in your case, law. You saw the opportunity within startups and venture, and you said, oh, I'm going to take a swing at that. But from your current perspective, smaller swings, maybe heavily influenced by what you were seeing in the media. You stepped back and you said, what can I really do with my life? How can I have outsized impact on this world? And now you're taking arguably the biggest swing of them all. And we'll get into why exactly I think that is, but tell us a little bit more about what is Temple and why do we need it and why are you working on it?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll answer that question. You know, these videos on YouTube where it's like expert explains concept in five layers of complexity. I'll do Temple, but in only two layers. I won't belabor it. But so Temple in the first layer of complexity, simply put, is we build autonomous cities to make the world more prosperous and beautiful. And we're started with one great city. We call it Temple One. And it's being planned and developed right now in Nigeria. 20,000 acres, 100,000 residents, anchored by an industrial park and a research university. So that's the basic, when people ask, okay, what are you doing today? This is what we're doing. What we want to do and what we want to grow into is this larger vision of like building a network and infrastructure to enable new experiments in governance and living around the world. And the reason why we want to do that is because we're essentially living in day-to-day, we're interfacing with like 21st century technology. Like, I'm sure you've noticed, you can't even get your eyes off Twitter, like the acceleration, so many things at once, like AI, crypto, you know, space, a few other things. But like at the same time, our institutions and our infrastructure is all 20th century. So there's this constant tension between those two things. And this tension to me became very acute in the post-COVID era, although I had an inkling it was going to happen, but like much later in the century. And so, but right after COVID, it seems like we've just hit on the accelerator and all the trends are just converging at the same time. And so the idea behind Temple is to update our institutions and our infrastructure by building these autonomous cities. So you use these cities as these like pockets of the future. And then you scale that around the world to distribute the innovations and the institutions via this network of cities. And if I could just give like a historical analog to this, it's the, please. I don't know if people have heard it, but you know, it's called the Hanseatic League. The Hanseatic League throughout history, medieval Europe, was this network of merchant towns around Europe that would share knowledge, information, talent, commerce, trade with one another to circumvent the sort of like the increasing piracy networks around the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, but also just in general, the dysfunctional and very small and unable to be open states, feudal states that they used to basically pay tribute to. And so they create this parallel network that in many ways is the precursor to capitalism and to the Renaissance that came right after it. And so we think that we're at a point in history where we can build this network of cities, autonomous cities, update you know, our environment using this new tech stack, and then export that to the rest of the world to show, wait, this is actually how much awesome our world could be.
On one hand, in theory, it's somewhat easy to grasp. But on the other hand, in practice, as you get into building this thing, it's infinitely complex.
Yeah.
And so we'll dig into the complexities of it in a second. I think one of the other very critical elements to highlight here is that you've intentionally chosen Africa and Nigeria in particular as ground zero for this.
Yeah.
As the flagship city. You talked a little bit earlier about you were born in Ivory Coast. You spent time in Senegal. Why is it, from a personal standpoint, so important to do this in Africa, but then also from a more pragmatic standpoint, why are the conditions right in Africa over the next century to make this the place?
Yeah. So I'll start with the pragmatic because, I think people will be probably more interested in knowing that first. I think that, so we call what we're building our autonomous cities frontier cities. But there is this broader lineage of new city development projects called charter cities, startup cities. It's a whole space that's been sort of like blown open in the last 12 to 14 years by Paul Romer, the Charter Cities Institute, a few other people. And the reason why we're making the distinction between charter cities and frontier cities is because we don't necessarily need to have full autonomy and sovereignty to be able to do what it is we want to do. If we're autonomous enough on certain vectors, we think we can be still successful. But the issue is that in the space, there really isn't, you know, beyond Asia and maybe beyond Africa, and if you in Honduras recently with the passing of the Zede laws, there isn't a lot of space around the world to use the existing regulatory frameworks to build highly autonomous cities. So special economic zones obviously exist around the world. Most of the time, they're just geared towards like building small industrial parks. They're not really interested in the broader, you know, social, cultural experiments you could do with new forms of governance. And so that limits the areas in which you could build these kind of cities. Like, for example, the US doesn't really have this framework. The EU, you know, that's a bit difficult because it is a very centralizing entity, right? So if you want to build highly autonomous cities in Europe, you know, good luck. I mean, it's, you want to do this in France? I mean, shit, like Macron is going to be like, you know, banging down your door. If you want to do it in the Balkans in that area, it's possible. But of course, like, it's very difficult to get the kind of, to get people from the US or Europe to move to those areas. So I was looking at, okay, pragmatically, you want to just be able to build where there's already significant demand pull. And if you look at where the fastest urbanizing regions of the world are, today it's only Africa and Asia. They're growing exponentially. I think both are about the 40% range in terms of urbanization. Africa, I think, is about 47%. So compared to, you know, the West, which is about 70%, 70 to 76, it's extremely urbanized. So there just isn't like that big of a demand pull. So to start, you want to catch an exponential curve, an exponential wave. And so Nigeria obviously is also the fastest urbanizing region in the continent itself. So so it's like, where do you want to go? Which has the which country has the regulatory framework? Nigeria has the free trade zones framework. Which country has the fastest urbanizing growth rate? Nigeria fits that bill. And which country has a young dynamic population, demographic explosion? Nigeria also fits that bill. And so that's where we picked that country. But of course, as you said, we want to scale over time beyond the continent. We're not just an African city company. We think that as a technology, frontier cities can benefit the entire world. That's the whole thesis behind our company. And so personally, of course, to answer the question, that's sort of the question, we started in Nigeria because in Africa, broadly speaking, because there's better founder market fit there. I obviously, as I said, was born in Ivory Coast. I know people in Nigeria, have connections there, and I care about the broader trajectory of the continent this century. I'm not sure if people know, Africa is experiencing one of the most explosive demographic growth probably ever in history. It's like, but by 2100, like something like 1 in 3 people will be African, according to courts, according to the UN data as well. There will be 3 billion Africans by 2050. That's double what we have today. That's not that far from now. 2050, it's like 30 years. So massive demographic explosion, if you don't turn that into something positive, not just for the continent, but the world, you get something like the Syrian refugee crisis times 100. They're not going to just stay on a continent if they can't actually build a life. They'll move. People move. This is what we know about history. When your condition is trash, you go somewhere where it's not.
One of the, I think, false impressions I had of this project when I started researching and learning more about Temple and the idea of charter cities, is that you are building entirely from scratch. I'm making it sound like this is less complex than it is. You're still building a lot of infrastructure. You have to build an entire culture, governance system, et cetera. But it is not entirely from scratch because you are, in your specific case, partnering with the Nigerian government. What is the relationship? If we zoom out in terms of history and maybe more recently in the U.S. Yeah. history, innovation has largely come, has been seeded as a result of public initiatives. You take the internet, for example, but then has been grown through private partnership or private development. And this is another example of that. You are taking private funding, but almost creating a new government of sorts, a new city of sorts, to then bootstrap further private enterprise. What is the right mix of private public relationship that will help Temple succeed? What does the relationship look like with Nigeria, with the larger geopolitical system, and with private enterprises?
Yeah, I think the broader point about your private entity bootstrapping on almost public sector, enterprise. The thing is that like it's only seems like an anomaly after the nation state, but when you look at right before that, like basically people think when people talk about the British Empire, they think it was like the crown directing all these activities. No, actually, it was a bunch of private capitalists that started a company called the British East India Company, and then went to India and basically, literally as a corporation, took over the country. It was Robert Clive, actually one guy who was an officer, not of the British Army, but the British East India Company, who actually conquered India for the British. And so when you look at the voyages of exploration, like it wasn't the Spanish crown, it was conquistadors, basically private citizens undertaking these immense projects of colony building. Same thing for when the British came to the US via, for the Virginia Company was what established the Virginia colony. So I think what makes this possible is that we're just living in a time when there's so much technological acceleration that individuals have greater leverage to do things that were previously only the domains of states. And so it's less crazy when you think about it as just a lineage of that, as a return to that state of affairs. But specifically in terms of like, the partnerships we're undertaking with the Nigerian government. So we think of building frontier cities as an elite coordination problem, meaning that it's not about having the best stack of laws. It's not about looking for regulatory arbitrage. It's not actually about real estate expertise. It's like, okay, you want to build this significantly autonomous city in this country, you need to have alignment with the elite present. They need to get a sense that they're benefiting from this. And so everything we're doing with how we're partnering with the government, we have someone on the ground who's very well connected in elite circles, and they are the ones coordinating and brokering the kinds of relationships and the face-to-face time we need with the right partners to get the concessions we need to be able to build something interesting, not just for ourselves, but for the community in which we're building. Because again, what we want to do is leverage existing demand for new cities on the ground to be able to get started. And so that's on the Nigerian side. In terms of private companies, we've already formed a lot of partnerships with construction company, a securing company. As I said, we have a mining piece, but as part of the project, we already have an exploration partner on board. We're going to start exploration in July, and there's also a few others, like a finance services company that is partnering with us to basically help bootstrap, general purpose financing and capital for SMEs in the city. And so we've very consciously, aligning a bunch of different partners to ensure that we have everything covered in terms of like, the right capacity to build this at scale. Because as you said, it's highly complex, but we also don't need to do everything. We just need to find a way to align our own incentives with the right people, and then the flywheel just gets going.
How are you making the decision about what to? I imagine some things are just entirely out of your control, like you being embedded within the Nigerian borders and governance structure. Sure. Necessarily means you can't do certain things, so that's out of your hands. But in terms of the realm of things you do have control over, how do you decide what to do? There's two ways I'm thinking about this. One is, how do you decide what to do yourself versus kind of export or delegate, import or delegate? And two is, even for those things you choose to do yourself, there's a tricky problem of balancing first principles thinking and then conventional wisdom. If you think about everything from first principles, the city's never going to get off the ground. There's so much research and understanding that has to be done. But if you lean on conventional wisdom, you inevitably end up more or less at the mean of where all previous civilizations have ended up. So yeah, I'm curious how you make a decision about what are we doing and where are we taking the time to have a fundamentally different approach than what we've done in the past.
For sure. I think in terms of what we're doing, the fundamental thing that I wanna own, right, and be like, no, you can't touch this. That's the full stack experience of one citizen, one resident in the city. Basically, like the entire, I want to be able to basically design the entire journey for what it means to, like, from the moment you hear about the city to when you actually land there, and how you actually spend a day, an hour, a week, a month, a year. That whole thing we want to own. So the way I really position, and I want to structure a temple moving forward. Right now we're a small team of about 4 or 5. In the future, though, it's as a very design-driven company. Like, I really see us more as like an Apple, but in the city building space, as opposed to like an Amazon, which is more like, you know, I don't know, a bit too autistic, right? I want to definitely retain the human interface element that Apple's so good at. And so what we're definitely going to control is that piece, is like, okay, designing not just the city itself, but just the experience of just from, you know, the entire life cycle of being a resident. Everything else we can contract out, you know, we can get a general contractor to basically get the infrastructure stuff built. We're doing the right biz dev to get the right consortium of partners to plug in the gaps. We're, you know, solve things, solve problems. There's a lot of experts in city building around the world. Like, we've been doing this shit for 12,000 years. There are a lot of people who know a lot of stuff about building cities. What you need to innovate on is the edge cases where you can actually turn the experience of being in a city just 1 to 2% better, but it's actually, the outcome is that it's 1,000% better because of the accumulated edge cases, right? It's like, for example, I don't know if you've lived in New York at all, but I used to live in New York for the last couple of years. And there's just a few things. If you just tweaked a few things, that city could be, well, some would say it's already the best in the world, but like, let's be 1,000%. We can love New York and say it could still be so much better. And that's kind of how we're seeing that. As far as like deciding, you know, the first principles approach or like, you know, best practices, I actually think, you know, there's this blog called, I think it's called, I forgot what the title is, but it's this blog site. I'll link it after the chat.
Yeah,
that really basically like it tackles career decision making and all that stuff. It's pretty interesting. One of the articles was about the failures of first principle thinking. And what it said was like, which I found myself to be true in my own experience, is like, first principle thinking, like it relies heavily on your premises and your axioms. And so the best case scenario is your axioms are true and reality is true. What actually happens falls from those axioms. Worst case scenarios is your axioms are still true, but the outcome is still false. Like literally your reasoning is entirely correct. You followed from the right principles, but because of the way life just repeatedly punches you in the face, you just couldn't, you know, predict something based on your axioms. And so I don't actually rely too much on first principle thinking. I think that what's important is just being able to, as I said, just focus on where you need to innovate, where you need to think differently. And in that area, just being willing to experiment, but just be determined to get the right answer. Like having that focus on, we're going to get this right, but we're going to make a lot of mistakes and we're going to try a bunch of different shit. But we have a vision of what we think right is. That's the important thing. It's not really a lean startup where you're just kind of like throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall. It's more like we have a sense of what right is because we trust our taste and good judgment. And then based off of that, you iterate in your experiment. But, you know, everything else you outsource to experts. I really believe in expertise, actually.
We're going to come back to experts in a second. I want to double click on this idea of having a vision or having like one kind of truth or philosophical or ideological underpinning that you like hang your hat on. You say that this is us, this is the ethos we're trying to create. What is that for Temple?
Yeah, so it's a stack of different things.
Yeah, I didn't mean to oversimplify it by saying
No, of course. Of course. No, I think that generally speaking, I think there's some things, I don't know who said this, maybe it was Steve Jobs, but he was like, there's some things companies have to be religious about. And so for us, it's a few things. One is decentralization. The broader thesis of Temple is that, I actually didn't get into that when we talked about what Temple is, but this is a very important part of it. And I think Balaji explained this very well in the network state thesis. The broader idea is we're going from this like command, centralized, bureaucratic nation state model where everything is uniform to this network model where everything is more decentralized. I just think that this is, it's an inevitability, and everything that isn't necessarily agile enough to deal with that new world is just going to struggle. And you're seeing already the nation state having problems with that. It's like the nation state borders are closed. In a network, it's a bit more loose, right? The nation state, your citizenship is just an accident of birth. In the network, you can talk to anybody, right? And so like a lot of these things just don't fit. And so that's why for us, you know, the network of cities is the thing. If we just build one city, it's a failure. If we only have one city in the network, because we're not going to build every city ourselves, it's also a failure. So it's like the decentralized approach we think is just going to win, and it's just more robust and resilient. So decentralization is a key part of something we're religious about. The other piece is one GM and all experts. Basically, we don't believe in managers managing managers. The only general manager should be me. And then after that, even that is a bit too much of a risk. Like at some point, you know, there's a kind of like your expertise you develop is just being the CEO of Temple. That is itself an expertise. So it should be like, I really do believe in devolving autonomy to experts, because that's kind of how you enable decentralization. If you just have a bunch of like fly-by-night cowboys, like you can get a lot of risky things done, but you might not be able to get them done well. So I think the best way to deploy generalists is probably on the fringes of your organization, or as opposed to like at the heart of what's difficult and complex. The other piece philosophically is this thing about beauty and design and being design driven. I'm someone that, like, you know, I grew up with a fine arts background. My family, a bunch of artists. My dad's a writer. My brother is a filmmaker. And so aesthetics, beauty in general, design is extremely important to me. And I think it's unfortunate that you can go to Toronto, Hong Kong, Shanghai, and not really get a sense of like a different environment. This is something that I think we've lost in modern cities, is that it's all a bit bland. Like, oh yes, it's impressive to see the Shanghai skyline, but you've seen one, like skyscrapers are like a 20th century technology. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's do something a bit more interesting. And I think that for us, like if you come to a temple city, Temple 1 or Temple 10, whatever it is, and it feels like you're still kind of in Toronto, that is a failure. That is a failure of vision, a failure of design. And that means we've dropped the ball. And I think philosophically, those are the things we want to be religious about. And just the general idea of like ambition, you know, make life. That is kind of the tagline of the video that we made to introduce ourselves to the world. Being able to realize that the world is not ending, but it doesn't mean we don't have to do dope shit, right? You don't always have to save the world to do impressive things. And I think that's kind of the legacy of the startup Web2 era, is like everybody wanted to save the world, but it's like you don't have to do that. You just can just build impressive things still.
And you may end up saving the world as a result of doing dope things.
Exactly. Precisely.
They aren't mutually exclusive.
Precisely.
You've mentioned experts a couple times now, and you said we've been building cities for 10,000, 12,000 years.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of experts out there that know how to build cities. But what are the more recent analogs or case studies of building city states? Like is Singapore the most recent example? The more direct question I'm hinting at is like, do we actually have more current experts, not just observers of people who have built past cities from scratch? There's absolutely experts in terms of like, you know, we need to do urban planning again, or we need to do housing development. But I mean, from scratch, experts. Are those out there? And how are you bringing these people onto the team?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm trying actually to think about the first part of that answer, that question, in terms of the actual case study for a city state or a city in general. I mean, there is a lot of city building happening, but I think you could probably just call this real estate development. It's like, I don't know if you've heard of Songdo in Korea. Mm-hmm. It's like a recent, very large scale, I think it was about a $50 billion project developed by this private company in partnership with a Korean company. They built buildings, you know, they built parks, they built a bunch of stuff that you would call a city. And they built it properly. They built it well. But the city is, I think, last time I checked, they are starting to get more population. But initially, when I first heard about it, it was like as a ghost town smart city project. Mm. And the issue with that in terms of like the city part is they just missed the cultural element. Again, that attention to what does it look like for one person to reside there for a minute, an hour, a year, that was missing initially. But even that's the fascinating thing about the cities, even with such a, I don't want to be rude or anything, but like such a like not as successful vision of a project is still kind of attracting people. And I think it's kind of like, mm-hmm. cities are very resilient and hard to kill. And so if you just build something that kind of is 1-2% better of what we already have, you're actually pretty set. But as far as case studies, I would say Songdo is pretty interesting. I read a lot into what they did. I think either Toyota or some other Japanese company is building a city from scratch as well. I don't think they've started, but obviously you have to say NEOM is the number one case study, right? NEOM, the city being built by MBS in Saudi Arabia. Like, I don't know, I'm not sure if you've heard about it, but it's like this
gigantic 5-mile city or whatever it is.
Yeah, a gigantic monstrosity of a project. I think the case study there is that it actually shows the downside to the expertise piece I'm talking about. They're hiring a bunch of experts as consultants to basically, because they have so much money, throw anything at the wall, any problem. And so they're going crazy. It's like basically a playground for them. And so they're abusing this kind of like, I think this is a modernist impulse. Like if you look at 20th century modernist cities, like Le Corbusier's plan for Paris, where it's like this very austere city, but like obviously very expertly planned and designed, but like just austere to the point of being unlivable. You're kind of seeing that as the pathology of expertise, actually. So that's what I would say is the danger there. But when I say experts in general, I don't mean like people who have built cities from scratch. I just mean people who've done big mega projects and killed that. Like they set out to do something big and they did it, and they hired an army of people to do it, and they were able to pull it off. One example is Mohammed Alabar in Dubai. By the way, you'll notice a lot of these examples are in foreign countries, which is mm-hmm. very interesting. Like the US, the West, they've stopped doing this kind of thing, you know. Right. Outside of startups, but like Mohammed Alabar, you know, he's the guy who basically dreamed and built the Burj Khalifa in Dubai. And I read the product management brief for this thing, just like completely amazed at the level of detail in which they planned everything. Like it's the kind of thing that you can't do with an army of generalists is really what I mean. Like every single layer of the stack, you had somebody who had like 20 years doing that one small thing. You know, like designing the foundations for the building, like the floor pattern they use to make sure that it's like so tall but still able to remain standing and withstand the sort of desert storms and winds in Dubai. So it's like that's kind of what I mean. Like Alabar himself is kind of a genius of building because he's got this other company building a bunch of real estate development properties, et cetera, et cetera. So he understands how to coordinate all these experts at scale, and he just doesn't shy away from the vision. Like, it's a big project. He knew that from the get-go, but they layered everything else so finely that it makes you. Here's a soundbite. When you have experts, you know you're gonna win, because it gives you more confidence in knowing that, like, that guy spent, or that woman spent 50 years. Sorry, that's a bit much. Let's say 25 years nerding out over which kind of cement it can be used to basically fortify X side of the building or whatever. Like, there's very peculiar questions that would escape people who are just kind of like generalists in the space.
And you can have individuals who have spent 20, 25 years in their respective field. But the risk ultimately comes back to the combination or the application of their specializations. Exactly. With others. And ultimately that falls on you to figure out how to mix and match those things, where the trade-offs are.
Precisely. How do you coordinate that? Yeah.
In that vein, what are the one or two or three kind of, if we're to do a bit of a pre-mortem here, what are the things that keep you up at night that you're like, if we don't do this well, this project will be a failure? What do you just have to get right?
Yeah. So, I mean, for us, the main thing, as I said, forget the network, the network vision, the new Hanseatic League. Our basic milestone is we have a decade to get Temple One done. If we don't do that, don't even talk to me about the rest of the stuff. So, like, that's the biggest thing, is that if we can't get this thing off the ground, then Temple One is the biggest failure mode. Not building Temple One is the biggest failure mode. And then it's like, okay, what does it take to build that? So there's three things that I can probably mention. The first thing is, capital risk, capital intensity. You know, it's not cheap to build a city. It takes several A rounds of a ride sharing company to be able to build just maybe, I think, the first two phases, right? And so it might be that when you look at the macro environment and what's happening with the bank crises and, like, the hike in interest rates, et cetera, it's not necessarily an appetizing time to build mega projects, you know, unless you have massive oil reserves. So there is a world in which the capital intensity of the project is just too great, and we're not able to raise the right amount of money or convince enough people that this is worth building. So that's a real failure mode. The second thing is just a political risk. As you said, Nigeria is not necessarily an obvious choice to build a new, dynamic, technologically advanced city. And so, because of course, you know, without mincing words, there is a real issue in terms of, like, the political stability of countries in Africa in general. And so this is where the elite coordination piece is so important, is because if you can guarantee alignment with certain elites, then you can secure the project in very real ways. But I think for us, that's not enough. What we want to do as well, you know, I'm American, even though I was born in Africa, in Ivory Coast. So what I do want to do is work with the U.S. government to secure these assets overseas, because at the end of the day, we are an American company, and it's important that the U.S. be involved in these kinds of projects, because right now China has been rampaging across the continent, you know, just financing all kinds of infrastructure projects. And they've pulled back a little bit, but, like, you know, it is a very real geopolitical risk if you kind of, like, cede the ground to other players. Right, Russia right now is also doing a lot of work in Mali. The Wagner Group, which is, like, this PMC, this Russian PMC private military contractor, has been increasing its presence on the continent and pulling back from other areas. And so, I think for the U.S. to have a player in the space, I think the frontier city space will become something akin to, like, what happened with the ride-sharing space, like, just a very key, critical industry to have, you know, the right players operating in. And so the last piece is the geopolitical risk. I think it could also be that there's just so many things you can't predict on the international real like arena, international relations arena. No one could have predicted. I mean, I guess a few people like John Mearsheimer, but very few people could have predicted Ukraine when it happened, 2022. And so, like, if someone, for example, say was building something in Ukraine, like what we're trying to do, that would have been a disaster. So, so those are important things. But you know, if you control what you can control, I think you can pretty much guarantee that like these failure modes aren't existential.
Coming from a software background personally, one of the things I love about software is the ability to develop agilely and make iterations, right? I can launch something this weekend and the next week I can iterate on it. The following week I can iterate on it. Yeah. That's not the case with atoms, with physical space, at least at the most foundational layer, the layers you got to build on top of. You can potentially, you know, although some of these things become ingrained as well, you can maybe tinker with ideology or culture and such. But you can't mess with the underlying infrastructure. What is the, you've secured the land, we also haven't talked about you securing rights to mine for gold. What are the right sequence of steps that set this project up for success?
Yeah. So the first big milestone is, well, I'll just talk about the concessions we got already. So the first one is, as you mentioned, we had this mineral exploration license for gold and lithium, actually. Lithium in an area of about 11,000 acres, a few hours away from where we want to build the city. And the reason why that's important is that gives us a floor for the project, a commercial base. A lot of projects in the frontier city space, they just don't really have an economic engine beyond trying to attract laptop workers and nomads from the West.
Right.
The issue with that is you can do sort of visa arbitrage with that. But the problem is, I think, again, with the acceleration we're experiencing, I read the study recently that, I don't know, I'm not precise with these things. I'll link them after the chat. But
yeah,
the study was essentially saying that something like 70 to 80% of a lot of what you would call knowledge work was going to be automated by these LLMs. And that included not basic stuff. It's actually like software, very, very difficult things to do, high paying jobs. Exactly what a lot of these projects are attracting. Thankfully, you know, automation in the real world is still kind of difficult. It's extremely difficult for robots, for example, to just be like have dexterity, you know. So that's a few years away. And so that allows us to bootstrap our city with a real industrial engine. And so that concession solves that. So that's the first biggest milestone. It's already done. We'll start exploration in July. The second milestone is, of course, getting, so right now we're negotiating 20,000 acres for the city, for negotiating a land concession. And that's the next big milestone, because we're still in the process of getting that done through our partners on the ground. And then once you have both the industrial engine and the land, you know, and we already have a consortium of partners that are helping us build the city. We have, again, security partners, construction partners, we have, you know, finance partners. The next piece is getting is just expanding that consortium and then coordinating them to build phase one. But before you build phase one, the big milestone is, like you said, the iteration cycles are smaller. So what you have to do is adopt, again, the Apple example, the hardware approach, where you design everything, right? Like, what does Apple do? It's like Johnny Ive and the design group conceive, design intricately every step, every feature of the project, of the product, of the iPhone you receive or the Mac you use. And they don't start the implementation process until it's perfect. And that's the kind of like focus and determination and discipline we need to have at the stage of master planning the city, doing the feasibility studies for the land, getting granular data on the topography. Like basically, we should be able to know every inch of that land concession, and we should be able to know exactly what we want to put on that inch. And once we have, at least for phase one, because once we have that, we can't, of course, master plan a whole city. I don't really believe in that, like the whole modernist era where they would just build full cities from scratch, like Brasilia. That's a failure mode for cities, for central planning. But you can build, like all complex systems start with a simple system. So you build the germinal city in phase one, and then phase two and three are about tweaking phase one or optimizing areas, expanding it in some ways. It's a bit much more like a bottom-up design approach as opposed to top-down. And so phase one is about creating those design constraints. And then once we're set, we love it, we want to build this, we activate our network of partners and players. And then, of course, while you're doing that, you have to get the marketing flywheel going, because while we are building for people on the ground in the region where we're building, we do want to attract the best talent, the most ambitious people in the world who are interested in playing at the frontier of governance, of technology, of just new forms of living. And that means communicating our vision for what that looks like and just selling the city. You know, I think one of the biggest mistakes in a lot of these other companies in this space is, I haven't seen the city yet. I don't know what it looks like. And they have many more dollars than we do, right? So we want to be able to show the city as soon as we can, and being able to give you a sense of what living in there will be like as soon as we can. So that's when you start. But there is also this phenomenon of like in silico design, basically like AI, tools like AI are enabling people in real estate to do a lot of really cool stuff where they can basically create like digital twins of entire real estate properties and cities and use that as a way to plan future development. So you can actually simulate, okay, if I add this building here, what does it do to this aspect there? So like after we have that germinal system, we can start the process of like digitizing the entire city itself. And then the you can kind of include software like properties to what is essentially an Adams infrastructure based thing. So there is going to be some kind of a merge eventually, or at least there should be, to be able to build these cities at scale properly.
Right. Yeah. I'm envisioning throwing on an Oculus headset and being able to A/B test the different urban plans.
Exactly.
That's a fascinating merge of atoms and bits, like you said. One of the pieces you mentioned was talent. And after kind of building the foundational infrastructure here and the culture or the ethos, ultimately you have to get it. It comes down to human capital, the success or failing of this project. One of your self-stated goals for this, this is a planetary level endeavor, but you're doing this in Africa for a particular reason. And you want to make Africa more beautiful and prosperous. I'm curious about the balance you have to strike between attracting African talent, but then also realizing there's other non-African talent that you want to pull in.
Yeah.
How do you balance optimizing for talent, but then also not negatively impacting the kind of socioeconomic ecosystem that exists in Africa today?
That's a good question. So I think that this is where being American is actually more instructive than it is destructive. So at least in the eyes of foreign people, because the key thing that you know, frontier cities, autonomous cities like Hong Kong, for example, Singapore, these dynamic cities, New York, what they're good at is, I don't think the right term is like multiculturalism or diversity. It's more like they're good at being beacons for the kinds of people who can thrive in unfamiliar environments and don't need to see themselves reflected in every single person they engage with. And so there's a kind of quality control for the founding residents that we will need to be vigilant over, to kind of like terraform that perspective in the first founding residents, whether they be already Nigerians or like whether they be foreigners as well. And so, as I said, what we want is a balance of about 60 to 80% domestic and then 20 to 30%, 40%, just like the best in the world at whatever they do or whatever they're at. And I think that's a good balance because, again, talent is like, it's just an equation of leverage, right? It's like they can do so much. They don't need to be to overpower your they don't need to be like numerically powerful to be able to be actually influential. And so the question then is like, if they're going to be that influential because they are so talented, then how do you align their productivity gains or their, I don't know, their impact and influence with the desires and wills of the people who are already there, who aren't as talented? And so what we want to do and actually, I think, innovate on, because I don't really see that being such a huge feature in cities today, is create an urban sovereign wealth fund from day one. And we already have the mineral wealth. That's going to help seed the fund. But generally speaking, align the wealth of the entire citizenry and residential population with the productivity gains from created by the people who are from other parts of the world. And then create a kind of like symbiotic relationship where it's like there's a floor for everybody, but there's a ceiling for nobody. And I think that's kind of like, that's kind of the new thing. It's like, yeah, like you don't want to cap ambition and upside, but you also don't want to be so obtuse as to think that like it's every man for themselves. I think that's one of the biggest problems in the US is even though individualism is a good insight, at least it was when it began, there are pathologies to it that like make people forget that they are part of a social body, right? Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have a responsibility for every single person in the social body, but you do, you are individuated by the society in which you live in. So that's an important thing to think about. And so the short answer is we're going to terraform the culture by just being intentional in who comes in. And then when we bring in these people, we're going to actually align their impact with the incentives of the people who are already there. And so creating that kind of flywheel allows us to have people from all kinds of background and create an interesting mix that can be dynamic as opposed to parasitic.
At the very beginning of the conversation, I said that in many ways, this is the moonshot of all moonshots.
Right.
This is 100 or 200 startups in one. You are effectively building a new kind of foundational layer for a new economic and technological advancement kind of era. You want to usher that in. And you see eventually a number of new enterprises being built on top of this stack. Mm-hmm. And you're being more proactive on that side of things as well. You're not just building Temple. You're also building Monolith. And I think they have some synergy there. So I think it's a good time to give people some overlap some context on what you're doing with Monolith and how those two interact.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually started Monolith before Temple as a kind of like a venture studio to incubate these kinds of like moonshot level projects. So I was always aware that, to be fair, I started Temple before Monolith, if we're honest. But the first iteration, I started it 2 years ago, but it didn't work, actually. So Temple is actually version two of another project. But can we
pause and go?
For sure.
Yeah, I want to hear more about that.
So this is actually the real founding story. But this is the thing that founders don't do. They always mythologize the founding story. The real stories are always more winding, right? So like around 2020, I started this company called The Foundation. It was going to be what Temple is today, which is building these frontier cities around the world. And our first that's kind of how I met the Praxis folks and then Eric Wahlberg and all these people, because I was in the Charter City space, so to speak, or trying to break in. And our first country was going to be in Ghana, because that is where I had some initial contacts. But they weren't as strong, and we didn't really have a good plan of strategy to coordinate that elite element yet. And the most important thing is they didn't have the existing regulatory framework to allow these kinds of cities. And so that's why a lot of the things that we're doing now that are working with Temple, it comes from that initial failure, or at least a false start. And right. So when I realized that,
call
like,
it a failure.
Yeah. Thank you. So when I realized that these were the bottlenecks, I sort of stepped back. And also, of course, capital, I was always aware was going to be a huge bottleneck. So I wanted to kind of have a vehicle that could be just focused on just like accumulating and just deploying capital. And so I was like, okay, what I need is a kind of two things. I need an institutional engine, basically, that includes research. That's what the foundation would become. And it still is to this day. It's a Temple subsidiary. Capital, which was going to be Monolith. And then the city building itself, which is now Temple. So Monolith became this venture studio. I was like, we can both fund and build projects. So we invested in this company called Afropolitan that is building a straight up network state project. So they're less focused on cities, but mostly on the cultural element of the network state thesis. So just if your viewers don't really know what that is, the network state is the idea proposed by Balaji that you can bootstrap new autonomous countries, communities in general, by getting a bunch of people who are values in line online, and then in the future bargaining for a piece of land somewhere to get sovereignty. And so Afropolitan wasn't the African version of that, where they wanted to do that for the African diaspora. And so we were one of the first checks through Monolith, and I was actually on the founding team to help them get the product off the ground. And the other company is this thing called Human, built by my friend Anthony LaRoche Jr. He's trying to build like a global self-sovereign identity network, kind of like allowing, I guess the best analog, if you know of the WorldCoin project, also the same element, what they're doing with WorldCoin ID is kind of like what Tony is trying to do, but without the orb, obviously. And so, and then Temple was the third project, which we took our time to incubate under Monolith and deploy. But, you know, now that Temple is spun out officially from the company, from the venture studio, what we want to do is use Monolith as a way to attract companies inside our cities. And then as a way to just, as I said, like generate, use a capital accumulation vehicle to be able to fund our cities sustainably at scale. So so we'll fund in projects, not just in Africa, but around the world, in the US as well. And use the cash flow from that to basically as kind of like an extra balance sheet to, you know, fund infrastructure projects for our cities, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what it's going to look like at scale. And then we're going to fold it into Temple as well as another subsidiary.
So you mentioned two of the projects that are kind of being built, I guess, at least in partnership with Temple currently. But you're building Temple with this incredibly long-term perspective, at least, next 100 years. What do you see being built on top of Temple 20, 50, 100 years from now? What are some of the other crazy?
Yeah.
This is a meta moonshot. What are the other moonshots being built
for sure
on top of it?
Yeah. So actually, you know, before getting into that specifically, I'll say that what's interesting, and I think what's the wave of the kinds of companies that Temple companies will be building is like, I think I just sent this tweet, actually. It was like, it's telling that, the three greatest frontier evidences of frontier technology over the last 20 years have been done by lone individuals, like attacking a formerly like a state, supposed to be a state function. It's like Elon with SpaceX, Satoshi with Bitcoin, and then now Sam Altman with OpenAI. And it just came out recently that he actually tried to get the U.S. government to fund OpenAI, but they just didn't get it. They didn't do it. And so, but like in the 50s, that's something that, you know, DARPA would have done, right? They built the computer, they built the internet. They're not doing that today, but they should have. They should have done this with AI. And so the tragedy of that is Sam now has to go to Microsoft to get 10 billy. The issue with that is it can corrupt the long-term trajectory of building this kind of like open, decentralized AI. Remains to be seen what happens. But I think we're entering a world in which individuals will have so much leverage that they will be able to basically destabilize small states with their inventions, right? And so I think what's going to happen is you'll still have, you know, small businesses like building things that we need daily, but like the real capital accumulating enterprise will be things that formerly were just the purview of the state. So I think, like, for example, you know, like Fusion, like let's say it is another Sam Altman entity, you know, Helion that actually figures it out. That is like something that the Manhattan Project did with nuclear energy before, right? So that's insane. Who knows what happened when that breakthrough arrives? It's going to destabilize our geopolitical environment even 10 times more than whatever AI is going to do. But it will be an individual who will have done that. And so, like space solar power, for example, these kinds of like large scale, you know, capital intensive infrastructure projects that essentially will be possible because now you'll have one person or maybe a team of 10 being able to use these LLMs to automate bureaucracy. In the future, you'll have an AI native funds that can just invest automatically like new ideas. So you conceivably will have one person being able to have a 10,000, you know, person, quote unquote, bureaucracy, capital on tap, at least to start out. And then being able to just deploy these entities to build these very complex things because materials will be cheaper to produce because someone else will have made them easy to produce by creating some kind of like, I don't know, replicator or something kind of like that. And so you'll be able to build these amazing things. Even temple cities in the future will be built that way, right? And so I just see by building these havens of autonomous governance that enable these individuals to thrive, and the upside they create to be shared with all society, you're building the infrastructure for this kind of abundance to be actually possible in a very real way and not just the purview of science fiction. And so, you know, terraforming as an industry becomes a thing. You know, space travel is less about sending cargo, but actually becomes a bit more about, you know, tourist voyages, right? So by the time we're on Venus, it's like the infrastructure we're using to live there is basically built by all the companies that were founded or funded by a temple entity or temple itself.
That's what I was going to say, was it lends itself very well to interplanetary travel and habitation. I know SpaceX is thinking a lot about this, but in many ways, this idea of being able to build a charter city or an autonomous city and having the blueprint for that complements something like what SpaceX is doing. So excited to see if I'm around at this point.
You will be. Things are happening so fast, man. I think the timelines are shrinking, man. The timelines are shrinking. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. What's that phrase? Sometimes years happen in weeks.
Right, right. It
feels like we've been having a lot of years happen lately with AI. I want to step back for a second. And so obviously Temple is a massive vision. There's only so much we can cover in the course of an hour, hour and a half.
For sure.
I touched on things that I found fascinating and wanted to highlight, but I want to give you an opportunity to touch on things that maybe we glossed over or entirely missed and that listeners might find fascinating. Mm-hmm. So you can give them more context on what you're doing and maybe additionally where to follow along and how to get involved.
Yeah, I think the first thing to probably touch on is I think double clicking on this idea of like, why do we really need this? Because like I mentioned that, you know, we live in this world where we have 21st century technologies but 20th century governance and infrastructure. The reason is like, how do we get to that point? The question rather. And I think the way we think about it is, there's, of course, it's a multivariate answer. But I think one of the biggest thing, the biggest meta trends that enables Temple is this death of the nation state idea that I briefly touched on. And the nation state is very recent. Right now, like, people really think that, you know, they can't really conceive of a world without countries. But I mean, try to think of one. I mean, can you even do that? Like, it's impossible. But the issue is that it's a very recent thing. It wasn't until the last couple hundred years, really, that it became solidified. Before that, the dominant mode of organization for society was the empire, which really is like a network of communities aggregated into one single whole by an emperor. And then you had the city-state, which really is much more ancient than the empire itself. Like, the first communities that harbored humans were like the city of Ur, Babylon, you know, these kind of Thebes, these kinds of cities. And what it shows is that, like, basically the nation state is an aberration. The question is, what does it come from? It comes from basically 1648, you know, Europeans were getting tired of killing each other and, like, invading each other over wars of religion. So they were like, yo, let's make a deal. And we solidify these borders in this treaty. No one attacks another. And then let's just go fuck up everyone else around the world. And that's what happens. And that's what happened, right? They basically agreed. It's like it was a mafioso deal. They were like, we're going to go around to get what we need resource-wise, but no one touches Europe. And so that's when the period of exploration really intensified. You had the voyages. Actually, that was before 1648, but it really solidified the trend of, like, you know, for example, the British made their first voyages around Africa and into India around 1600, 1700. The French did the same. There was also a French East India Company. The Dutch, obviously, they rose to power immediately right after that. And then, of course, you know, the rise of colonial empires is what accelerated World War I and World War II. Like, it was the fact that they were all competing for these contested pieces of land in Africa, in India, in China, in Asia, broadly speaking, that and using that to basically compete at the race of industrialization that eventually Germany and the British and the Russians got into it with World War I. So you don't get, I like to say this, like, the nation state, the great sin of the nation state is World War II. You don't get World War II without any of that happening. And so, and when you look at the decolonization period, right, you had all these empires breaking. All the countries we have today, all 100, I don't know, 63, 93, or whoever knows how many, it just keeps growing because it's stupid. Like, all of these countries, basically, you can trace their origin from, like, a boundary break of the French, the British, or the German Empire, right? And so they're artificial and they're arbitrary in very real ways, in ways that have created conflicts around the world since then, like in the Middle East. Like, that whole mess is a direct result of the break of the Ottoman Empire and the sort of great game that the British and the Russians were playing with each other in that region. You know, right. In Africa, you had, of course, you had 2,000 ethnicities and 3,000 languages, and you mashing together the Hutu and the Tutsis. And of course, in 1994, there's a genocide, right? The Armenian genocide. Like, all these atrocities are aftershocks of structuring the world in a nation state first world. Okay, that's the end of the history lesson. The point is that it's an aberration. And not only is it an aberration, it's been one for the last 50 years. But now, if you project forward, it will be an even greater one in the next 100 years as the technologies that we're all building. I mean, you work in software. Like, we're all contributing to using and building this infrastructure. What we're building is something that doesn't vibe or jibe well with a world in which one passport, one identity, closed border, like, it just doesn't fit. You're going to mash things together that are that's going to create problems. So what I think happens is hyper-localization, that's going to happen at the level of small cities, small to medium to large size cities, and then hyper-planetarization. And so there'll be some new structures to coordinate all of this. There probably will be software-based as opposed to like large bureaucracies. They probably will be largely automated because you don't need large bureaucracies anymore with the kind of trends that we're riding. And so that is one big piece of why we think these cities are important, is because it helps us build the coordination infrastructure for this new world. And they have to be new because we need to experiment with what that actually looks like on the ground. And because there is a lot of demand for new kind of urban environments and spaces.
I think that's very helpful historical context for why you're doing what you're doing, and then also why the, maybe more importantly, why the timing is right to be working on this. So super helpful. In closing, I always like to ask the same question of everyone, which is to turn it back on you. What's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on? And it can be related to Temple or something entirely separate.
Yeah, that's a good question. Damn. What's one question? Yeah. I would say something like, what is something that you keep repeating yourself that someone should really do this fucking thing, right? Like this, you keep repeating this to yourself and also at the same time believing yourself not to be that someone. What is that question? And then why do you think you're not equipped to do it? Because I think, you know, just outside of Temple in general, honestly, like the I'm doing this thing now, but the as I said, the story was extremely windy. Like I was very much susceptible to the kinds of like influences that everyone is. Like I'm not some kind of unique individual. You are influenced by your environment and the stories that are around you. You know, as I said, the social network was a big one, but the problem is that it kind of like almost strapped me into a kind of a mode of building. I was like, oh, it has to be software. It has to be blah, blah, blah. It has to be this kind of thing that makes me a lot of money fast, right? Like everyone's susceptible to these kind of mimetic traps. And I think the reason why I asked the question, like, why is it something that you keep wanting other people to do, is because usually it's a reflection of what you yourself should be probably at the very least thinking about, if not acting on. And but if action is what you're interested in, then I would think one should think more about what that voice in your head is forcing you to ponder, but most importantly, forcing you to believe you're not suited to it, to tackling yourself. So that's also a psychological thing you have to worry about, is like feelings of inferiority or incompetence, things like that.
Right. But, it's a combination of mimetics and self-limiting beliefs.
Exactly.
And that's an excellent challenge to end on. Something I've been thinking a lot about lately. I personally wrestle with this idea of, well, let me make money relatively quickly on the order of like 3 years, and then let me go do what I really want to do with my life.
Right.
Which, by the way, I don't entirely know what that is because I haven't taken enough time to figure it out. And so maybe that's the actual starting place.
Interesting. Yeah.
Do that work sooner, because you may find out, like you did, I should be working on the longer term thing now, because that I am capable of doing that and it is more fulfilling. I don't have to go make the quick money just because that's what it looks like everybody else is doing, and that's kind of the conventional wisdom that's out there. So I think that's a great challenge to end on.
And it's a paradox, because one more thing. It's just a paradox, no, because you end up making the money doing that, right? That's really all you care about, like it's going to come either way doing that. Not necessarily and not initially, but it's highly likely that if it comes in great sums, it will be through doing that.
Well, Alpha, this has been incredible. I will drop in the show notes where people can find you and Temple. And for those that are interested, even apply to be one of the early residents.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And yeah, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on.
Thank you so much, Spencer. Really great questions and really appreciate you.